Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, happy fall, everyone. And no better way to start than an ode and a plea to autumn. Fall, the autumnal season. The words themselves have a rich sound, bringing to mind chestnut brown tweed jackets and golden brown apple pies. Although the temperatures are a little warm here last week, we haven't given up hope of curling up in front of a blazing fire with a cup of hot cider and a good book. Maybe one of these weekends we'll even need a jacket at the high school football game. I think this weekend will be the time. Until the weather aligns itself with the calendar, we'll keep dreaming about our favorite ways to enjoy this glorious season. Fall is all things apple. Slightly chunky homemade applesauce, dark brown apple butter loaded with flavor, diced Granny Smith apples cooked in butter and brown sugar, moist applesauce raisin cake covered with brown sugar frosting, steaming apple cider with a touch of cinnamon and cloves. And most lately, I started to enjoy these Cortland apples, very delicious apples, with a very nice, white, crisp meat to them. You got to try them. What would fall be like without warm apple crisp, sweet and crunchy, yet tart and tangy? Of course, the ultimate all-American apple dish, apple pie, baked in a flaky, buttery crust sprinkled with white table sugar, is perfect, actually, for any season. And no fall is complete without a trip to an apple orchard and the apple picking, eating, bobbing, and baking that follow. A caramel apple on a crisp fall evening will melt away time at least for a little while. In fall, the smell of outdoor cooking is different than it is in summer. The breeze carries woodsy, smoky scents, wrapping people in comfort like an old flannel shirt. The air smells sharp, tangy, and reminiscent of woods, damp leaves, and the promise of colder weather to come. The smell isn't salty as it is in winter, but full of pleasant, embracing odors. Cinnamon, ripe fruit, and rain-soaked ground. Since fall is the perfect time for keeping the windows open, the scents fill houses, enticing people outdoors. And whether the cookout smell is coming from a campground or a backyard, it always encapsulates the feel of sitting around an open fire in the middle of the woods, sipping cider from a mug, filled with a sense of peacefulness and also liveliness. Strange in a season when life is beginning to wind down. As the temperature drops, the indoors offers new allurements. Building the first fire of the season or stocking the workroom with all the supplies needed to finish a favorite project will help while away rainy fall afternoons. Scented candles, fabric leaves, homemade scarecrows, gourds, and pumpkins make the home cozy and inviting. Fall has no patience for the short and skimpy. So tank tops, capri pants, and flip-flops, they're all gone. Now's the time of the boot, ankle boots, knee-high boots, over-the-knee boots, suede boots, leather boots, furry boots, black boots, brown boots, candy apple red boots. This is also the time of the jacket, from sturdy wool military-inspired pieces to long sweater coats. Like fashion, football, the most famous of fall pastimes, pays no heed to weather, whether at the high school game, college, or professional level. The one-game-a-week rhythm builds to a powerful crescendo right before kickoff. Supporters wear paint and diehards refuse to wear shirts as temperatures plummet. The bone-jarring tackles are a dramatic departure from the restrained atmosphere of baseball and golf. A touchdown is celebrated like a lottery jackpot, and victories mean fans can hold their heads high for at least another week. Yes, fall has much to offer, and summer now is but a fond memory. Fall, the autumnal season. So some thoughts on fall, and I thought we'd listen to a little music from Henry Mancini from the movie 10, one of the great love songs. It's easy to say, and we'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show. Henry Mancini from the movie 10, the love song, It's Easy to Say. And we're back on the Kevin Moore Show. The Joffrey Ballet opens its 2019-2020 season with the Chicago premiere of Kathy Marston's enthralling adaptation of the classic novel Jane Eyre, presented at the Auditorium Theater in 10 performances only October 16th through the 27th. The 2019-2020 season marks the Joffrey's final season at the Auditorium Theater. The company moves to the Lyric Opera House with the start of the 2020-2021 season. Presented in partnership with American Ballet Theater and set to music by Philip Feeney, Marston's celebrated adaptation of Charlotte Bronte's classic novel combines theater and dance to tell the coming-of-age story of one of literature's most iconic characters. This production of Jane Eyre challenges the idea of classical ballet heroine. After a difficult upbringing, Jane becomes the governess for the mysterious Mr. Rochester, discovering the struggles of society's expectations. with stirring choreography and a captivating Victorian design. This avant-garde ballet shows that love can conquer any obstacle. Kathy is breaking glass ceilings in the ballet world, and with Jane Eyre, she creates an unconventional heroine whose trials and passions are beautifully articulated through choreography, said Ashley Weider, the Mary B. Galvin Artistic Director of the Joffrey. We are thrilled to bring her adaptation of Jane Eyre to Chicago for the first time following its successful North American debut with American Ballet Theater this past June. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning star of stage, screen, and television, world-renowned dancer, having performed with the legendary Rudolf Nureyev and Margot Fonteyn, teacher, mentor, member of the Royal Ballet, former ballet master of the San Francisco Ballet, visionary in the world of dance, and the artistic director of the world-famous Joffrey Ballet, now presenting the Chicago premiere of Kathy Marston's Jane Eyre, October 16th through the 27th at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University. Our good pal, Mr. Ashley Weider. Ashley, welcome back to the Kevin Moore Show.
Hi, Kevin. It's great to be back on your show.
Always a pleasure. I hope you had a good summer.
I had a great summer, actually. It's been super busy with getting the season together. But, everything has been really good, and we're thrilled to be opening our season with Kathy Marston's Jane Eyre. I mean, it really is such a beautiful work.
A great but tragic romantic novel, of course, by Charlotte Bronte. And very interesting to put this to dance. It has to be a challenge to do that because there's a lot of intricate storylines, a lot of different characters and so forth impacting one another. And, of course, as it said in the introduction, a coming of age of this young woman to who she becomes ultimately and finds love.
Absolutely. I think that Kathy is a rarity in the dance world and particularly in the ballet world, in that taking narrative and being able to take words off a page and transform them into physical language can be very difficult. And I think that what is extraordinary about her, and also about, you know, her telling of Jane Eyre, is that it's very clear. You know, the scenes really tell you the journey that Jane is taking. And I think that Kathy has, you know, she grew up, both her parents taught literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Kathy probably grew up always having a book in her hand. And her adaptation, I mean, I think that, you know, I feel very fortunate because I'm in the studio every day with her. And her honesty about being true to the characters. And you're right, Kevin, there are so many characters and they need to be really defined. And I think that Kathy, like in her way of coaching people, but also in her choreography, she's really depicted those characters really, really clearly. You know, not only Jane and Rochester, but also Mrs. Fairfax, young Helen, who dies at the orphanage, the horrible aunt who doesn't want Jane, wants to take Jane on after her parents pass away.
Mrs. Reed, right.
Yeah, it's deep and it's really dense. But it's a beautiful story, really well told. And I think what's interesting about the music, which is by Philip Feeney, is that he has woven into the score both Fanny Mendelssohn and Felix Mendelssohn and some of Schubert.
Mm.
And so it's really beautiful, like how it evokes, Jane and her journey, because we keep hearing the theme of Jane. And so I think for the audience that you have to kind of just absorb it because there's a lot. There's a lot to take in.
Well, there's a lot of themes in the book, and it's transposed into the ballet, the themes of class and sexuality and religion and feminism. And this told from a first-person point of view, which is interesting. And to your point, Ashley, as far as the characters go, it's difficult enough in the novel to follow all the characters because you can always go back to, well, what page was that on? Let me get that introduction again. But here we are on a stage, and Kathy is doing such a good job of explaining that to us as we watch what she's doing on the stage.
Right. And she, you know, Kathy's taken it from the point of view that Jane has fled Rochester after the fire and knowing that he's already married.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, St. John or St. John. In the book, it's St. John, but people also call him St. John.
St. John, right.
Finds her. And so from that point of view, you kind of go in flashbacks to young Jane and how she arrived at where she arrives at. And I think that, the character of Brocklehurst, you know, all those characters need to be so well understood that they're able to really define it. And I think it's been a fantastic kind of acting seminar for the company to dig into characters, but also dig into the choreography and bring it to the fore. And I said to the company this morning that it has been incredibly satisfying to see them really bring this work to life. I had seen it in London, and I loved it. I saw it at American Ballet Theatre as well. But I love that the company are not afraid of anything, and therefore they dig in really deep. And I think that what we have is a very textured, very multi-layered telling of Jane Eyre.
And it must be difficult also, but also challenging, not only the choreography, Ashley, but the sets and making sure the sets are, coordinated with what's going on stage.
Right, because as you said in the introduction, the set is an abstraction of Yorkshire, the mm-hmm. north of England. Right. And if you've ever been to the north of England, especially outside of York, you find the moors are very, very barren.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's kind of beautifully depicted without being literal. And so even with going to the orphanage or going to Rochester's home, we know where we are in time and place,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't have huge amounts of scenery.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite sparse. And I think that Kathy has used the human body to be when Jane is first at Rochester's and she's wandering through the house and she looks at the chandeliers and she looks at the furniture, well, there are people that are those pieces of furniture. And I think the one thing that Kathy wanted to do was to add, because there are not many men in the book, there are four men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she wanted to add more men. So there are these demons, and they're demons in Jane's mind. They're pulling her back. They're doubting her. She's pushing forward. And so we see these characters, kind of dark shadows, they're a sinister presence for Jane. And in spite of all of that, she pushes through it because she knows she wants a better life.
And I would suggest, Ashley, that, and I do this, whenever we're chatting or we're talking to people in theater or ballet or the music, it would help that person who's going to the ballet, going to enjoy Jane Eyre, go on the Joffrey website, and there is a synopsis of what the story is. So it familiarizes yourself with what's going on stage. So you're not challenged as to what's happening now. Well, if you know the storyline, I tell this to my kids when they're going to the theater, read the story about it so you can join the art of what's, whether it's music, whether it's dance, whether it's theater, and understand what's going on. So all you can do is then get immersed in what's happening on the stage there so you know what to expect next.
Absolutely. And the other thing, Kevin, that we've added, I think, is going on the website today and also in the program is it's a kind of meet the characters. Who are these characters and how do they play a role in Jane's life?
Interesting.
And I think that that has been really, really educational for people to know that Mrs. Fairfax is the housekeeper of Rochester, to know who Brocklehurst is. So it's been very good. So I do think that, of course, the more you know, the more you get out of anything.
Right. And interesting with Kathy Marston, we talked about this initially, what she's put to dance, and shows her background in literature. She's done Nabokov's Lolita. She's done D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley Lover. She's done Ibsen's Ghost. So she's immersed in that literature to be able to familiarize people with what's going on in a book or a novel to what she's going to put on stage. That's remarkable.
It is remarkable. And she is incredibly well organized. And it's very clear to her. You know, she did something for the company that I thought was really good. Every character, so if we take Jane or Rochester, she has a list of words that she feels represent those characters. So we have a huge board outside our big studio, and on that board are all the characters and the words that Kathy has put that for her are the descriptions of that personality. And I think that that has also been kind of a wonderful thing for the company to be able to read them, look at their character, and then digest those adjectives that she's used.
Because you're always thinking of that in your mind as you're portraying that character or on stage dancing with that character. You're thinking about that's the inspiration for that character. That's the feeling. That's the concept of that character. That's an interesting interesting way of doing things.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, she is such a joy, and I really respect her so much. And so I am really thrilled, Kevin, that we have her at the Joffrey. She is absolutely loving working with the company. I think she feels that it's really fulfilling for her as a choreographer, and I'm really thrilled that this is the first time that the audiences are going to get to see her work, but it certainly isn't the last, because she is going to come back next year and do a world premiere for us.
I had a feeling that we're going to see Kathy Marston's work again.
Most definitely. I think, you know, there is a big conversation about, you know, the lack of women choreographers that are working today, and you know, and if I look at our art form, the art form of classical ballet, there are not so many women working in the language of classical ballet. There are more women working in a more contemporary language. But I think that Kathy is, there's a reason that she's in demand all over the world. You know, and I think that, you know, we need, I think that the other thing is that people love work that they feel that's relative to them. And if you look at this wonderful story, there are so many parallels of the time that it was written and the times today. You know, we keep kind of making things up as we go along through the years, and you know, people fall in love and people are deceived, and you know, these same emotions and situations keep occurring.
And we see this, it's true, and I think what's remarkable about this is that we have the opportunity to enjoy this in our great city with this great ballet and the terrific and wonderful job you and your staff and your people are doing. And it continues time and time again, Ashley, that how long has this been in production? How long have you been thinking about working with Kathy and this particular work?
Kathy and I sat down, I think it was like 3.5-4 years ago.
Is that right? Jeez.
Yeah. Wow. And we had a fantastic meeting. I had always wanted to really sit down with her and kind of get a plan together. So it's really fantastic that this is now happening and that Kathy is here and that she's getting to know the company, because I think that when you get to know your company, it makes the next project even more fulfilling. And the other thing, Kevin, is we live in an incredible city. And if you think of Chicago and how the arts are so important to Chicagoans, and theater has been kind of the backbone of art in Chicago. So I think that on so many parallels, it's beautiful storytelling, it's great acting, it's fantastic music. You know, it hits all the values that I think Chicagoans want to see in a performance.
Is it a challenge for the company to do something of this intricate nature?
It is, because you kind of have to leave your ego outside the door, and you have to immerse yourself in the character. And you know, particularly like the role of Mrs. Fairfax. Like if you read the book, she's kind of fussy and she's quite endearing and she cares, but she's irritating as well. And so the way Kathy has choreographed for her, You have to let go. You cannot be inhibited by it. You have to dig in and dive in and bring that character with all the nuances that come with her to the fore. So I think it's been tremendous.
Well, it's something that we're all looking forward to, certainly, and it starts next week, and it's going to be a great initial kickoff for what's, I guess, a little bit sad, huh, the final season at the Auditorium Theater, Ashley?
Yes, of course. You know, it's been, like, the Auditorium has been amazing to the Joffrey, and, you know, I think that, you know, we haven't really thought about it kind of from an emotional point, but I know that when we get to our last performance in April, May, which will be Don Quixote, I know that suddenly the reality will hit home that we are not opening the next season there, but we're actually moving to the Lyric. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we're really excited to be moving to the Lyric. I think that the partnership with the Lyric Opera, it's allowing us to do, you know, many other things and to be a little bit more ambitious. And so I think, you know, it's sad on one, you know, it's sad and there's a huge emotional attachment to the Auditorium. It's a beautiful venue. And yet we're looking at the opportunities that the Lyric will bring us.
And I think that it'll allow you to grow also. And that's how a company stays vibrant and lively, is to continue to change.
Absolutely. And, you know, Kevin, this is the 25th year that the Joffrey has called Chicago home. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is really important. You know, this is the home for the Joffrey. And we've made great strides since we moved to Chicago. And I cannot thank the support that we have had from our audience, from the city, from every other major arts organization about us being here. And I think that Chicago is one of those cities where we can all work together for the greater good of our city. And I find that is a unique and it's a gift that this city has encouraged throughout the performing arts.
Well, it's a gift to have the Joffrey here, and that's our gift here too. And of course, with this kickoff with Jane Eyre, we're looking forward to my favorite, you know, the Nutcracker coming back, Christopher Wheeldon's holiday classic, becoming a tradition there now.
It is. It really is doing. I mean, I have to say that I'm always thankful when the box office is looking really good, and every day we have a really good day of revenue. But it's great that, you know, Chicago has really embraced Christopher Wheeldon's idea of the Nutcracker, which he set in Chicago. And it's a beautiful story. And I think that the one thing that I always felt about the Nutcracker was we wanted a full story about a journey. And we have that now, thanks to Brian Selznick, the brilliant children's author, who wrote the synopsis for our new Nutcracker with Chris Wheeldon.
Well, that starts, of course, November 30th and plays throughout the holiday season, and it's something that everyone looks forward to. And, of course, I always look forward to chatting with you about it, so I look forward to that too. Classically trained to the highest standards, the Joffrey Ballet expresses a unique, inclusive perspective on dance, proudly reflecting the diversity of America with its company, audiences, and repertoire, which includes major story ballets, reconstructions of masterpieces, and contemporary works. The company's commitment to accessibility is met through an extensive touring schedule, an innovative and highly effective education program, including the much-lauded Academy of Dance, official school of the Joffrey Ballet, community engagement programs, and collaborations with a myriad other visual and performing arts organizations. Founded by visionary teacher Robert Joffrey in 1956, guided by celebrated choreographer Gerald Arpino from 1988 until 2007, the Joffrey Ballet continues to thrive under the Mary B. Galvin Artistic Director Ashley Weider and President and CEO Greg Cameron. The Joffrey Ballet opens its 2019-2020 season with the Chicago premiere of Kathy Marston's enthralling adaptation of the classic novel Jane Eyre, presented at the Auditorium Theater in 10 performances only, October 16th through the 27th. The 2019-2020 season marks the Joffrey's final season at the Auditorium Theater. The company moves to the Lyric Opera House with the start of the 2020-2021 season. On the line with us right now is the artistic director of the Joffrey Ballet, Ashley the Weider. Ashley, I'm going to give a phone number if people would like to get some tickets, 312-386-8905. We'll look forward to seeing you next week, my pal.
Thank you, Kevin. I look forward to seeing you too. And, you know, my very best to you and to all your listeners. And I think that if you want to be immersed in some really great theater, then come down to the Auditorium and catch Jane Eyre, because I think it's a very, Really beautiful, beautiful work.
One of the new classics of the repertoire of ballet, which we're going to be listening to and enjoying for years to come.
Yep, I hope so.
Thank you, my pal.
Okay, thanks so much, Kevin. Take care.
Take care. Ashley Weider, our good pal from the Joffrey Ballet, the artistic director, again, for tickets, 312-386-8905. Kind of sad that the last year at the Auditorium Theater, but great things coming up at the Lyric Opera, and we'll certainly look forward to chatting with Ashley coming up to my favorite in a month or so, The Nutcracker. Again, tickets numbers 312-386-8905. Years ago, when I was a boy, and they still had the Chicago Tribune magazine, every autumn they would publish a great cartoon by John T. McCutcheon. It was entitled Injun Summer. It was an earlier era celebration of autumn and childhood imagination, and it took on a life of its own, almost literally. The famous cartoon first appeared on September 30th, 1907, on page one, the front page of the Tribune, the answer to a looming deadline on a slow news day. John T. McCutcheon, inspired by a string of beautiful, warm autumn days and remembering his youth in Indiana, conjured up the illustration that became one of the most popular features in Tribune history. Usually runs in October, usually sometimes around Halloween. And as I said, John T. McCutcheon was from Indiana. He attended Purdue University and was considered the Dean of American Cartoonists. He won the Pulitzer Prize for cartoons in 1932. So I'd like to read this, as I do to my own children and grandchildren every year, and try to do it in the vernacular, which is written by John T. McCutcheon. From the Chicago Tribune, September 30th, 1907, Injun Summer. John writes, "Yep, sonny, this is sure enough Injun Summer. Don't know what that is? I reckon, do you? Well, that's when all the homesick Injuns come back to play. You know, a long time ago, long afore your granddaddy was born even, there used to be heaps of Injuns around here. Thousands, millions, I reckon, as far as that's concerned. Regular, sure enough, Injuns. None of your cigar store Injuns, not much. They was all around here, right here where you're standing. Don't be scared. Ain't none around here now, leastways to no live ones. They've been gone this many a year. They all went away and died, so they ain't no more left. But every year, long about now, they all come back, leastways their spirits do. They're here now. You can see them off across the fields. Now look real hard. See that kind of hazy, misty look out yonder? Well, them's Injuns. Injun spirits marching along and dancing in the sunlight. That's what makes that kind of haze that's everywhere. It's just the spirits of the Injuns all come back. They're all around us now. See off yonder? See them teepees? They kind of look like corn shacks from here. But them's Injun tents, sure as you're foot high. See them now? Sure. I knowed you could. Smell that smoky sort of smell in the air? That's the campfires a-burning and their pipes a-going. Lots of people say it's just leaves burning, but it ain't. It's the campfires and the Injuns are hopping around them to beat the old Harry. You just come out here tonight when the moon is hanging over the hill off yonder and the harvest fields is all swimming in the moonlight and you can see the Injuns and the teepees just as plain as can be. You can, huh? I knowed you would after a little while. Do you ever notice how the leaves turn red about this time of year? Well, that's just another sign of redskins. That's when an old Injun spirit gets tired dancing and goes up and squats on a leaf to rest. Why, I can hear him rustling and whispering and creeping around among the leaves all the time. And ever once in a while, a leaf gives way under some fat old Injun ghost and comes floating down to the ground. See? Here's one now. See how red it is? That's the war paint rubbing off in an old engine ghost, sure as you're born. Pretty soon, all the engines will go marching away again, back to the happy hunting ground. But next year you'll see them trooping back, the sky just hazy with them, and their campfires smoldering away, just like they are now. John T. McCutcheon, Injun Summer. Now, the cartoon that John draws is, he's out in the field with his grandson, and he has a rake, and he's smoking a corn cob pipe and looking out at the corn shocks. And he has a little fire of leaves that are burning. The moon's high in the sky. So then he envisions those same corn shocks with his grandson as teepees. And the smoke coming out of the burning leaves is engines. And those leaves that are falling down, turning red, are redskins. Now, what was politically correct then certainly is politically correct now. That was one of the reasons that I think that there's been less of a enthusiasm for Injun Summer, but certainly it's part of our history, because some would say that it's a bit critical of the American Indian, but it's a long time ago, and certainly it's something that's very special between a grandpa and his grandson, as they're sitting raking leaves on a cold autumn night with the moon lighting up the field. Injun Summer, from the Chicago Tribune in September 1907. Let's listen to a little music again from Henry Mancini. One of my favorites, Charade. And we'll be back on The Kevin Moore Show. Thank you. Henry Mancini from the movie with Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, Charade. And we're back on the Kevin Moore Show. Well, maybe the best way to begin my conversation with our next very special guest is to quote from who we'll be talking about and some of his famous words. So maybe you can guess who this will be. The game's afoot. He says, it's my business to know what other people don't know. You see, but you don't observe. The distinction is clear. And there is nothing more deceptive than an obvious fact. And finally, what's attributed to him, but he never said it really, elementary, my dear Watson. First Folio Theater presents Sherlock's Last Case through November 3rd. To open its 24th season, First Folio Theater, Mays Lake Peabody Estate, 31st Street at Route 83, will begin with the literary-inspired productions Sherlock's Last Case by Charles Merowitz. A threat hangs over the world's most famous detective as he faces an opponent he never expected. This thrilling adventure mixes suspense, humor, and breath-stopping surprises. Directed by Janice Blixt, Sherlock's Last Case runs through November 3rd. Sherlock's Last Case is the Holmes and Watson story audiences would never expect. When Sherlock Holmes' life is threatened, it's up to the ever-dependable Dr. Watson to solve the case. But as the tale wends its way along, bringing not only Inspector Lestrade, but also the children of their arch-nemesis, Professor James Moriarty, no one will be ready for the truths that are revealed. We are thrilled to present this action-packed production of Sherlock's Last Case to First Folio Theater audiences this fall, said director Janice Blixt. Acting as a love letter to 221B Baker Street and to individuals that cherish Sherlock Holmes. I think in the United States we call them Sherlockians. In Britain they call them Holmesians. Our production of Sherlock's Last Case combines danger, humor, and excitement with creative character direction, costumes, and scenery that will play with familiarity for audience members. First Folio Theater in the gorgeous Mays Lake Peabody Mansion is the perfect backdrop for an inquisitive play full of tricks and surprises that only Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson could solve. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning director, having led the production of such Shakespearean classics as Julius Caesar, Midsummer Night's Dream, and Hamlet. Janice has directed Chekhov's The Seagull and Weil's The Importance of Being Earnest. She is the artistic director of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, a member of the First Folio Theater family, and one of the brightest stars in the world, Chicago Theater, now directing the Charles Merowitz production of Sherlock's Last Case at First Folio Theater, located at Mays Lake Peabody Estate, Route 83 and 31st Street in Oak Brook, Ms. Janice Blix. Janice, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Hi, thank you so much, Kevin.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, I have to say I'm an amateur Sherlockian.
Well, I think a lot of people who are coming to see this are feeling the same way. I mean, he's so recognizable through all of the movies that he's done and through the books that everyone has read. And, I mean, every few years there's a new Sherlock Holmes. There's a new television show. You know, the BBC's been doing one for the past 10 years with Benedict Cumberbatch. So I think it's just something people like going back to all the time because he's such a great character.
Well, we try to figure out what his next move is, but none of us ever can. So that's what it is.
That's exactly right.
And, of course, this is an exciting new play that Charles Merowitz has put together, and you're directing it. What a great place for it, too, at First Folio Theater.
Oh, it's wonderful. Out at that mansion, if you've never been, it's at the Mays Lake Peabody Estate in Oak Brook, and it's this beautiful, sprawling old mansion, and the theater itself at First Folio is in the chapel. And so when you get there, you're automatically already kind of steeped in this, you know, manor house kind of feeling. And it's not spooky because it's a lovely place, but it's definitely full of atmosphere.
Well, we've been enjoying Sherlock Holmes for over 125 years, and we're still doing that now. Why is that, Janice?
I think, like we said before, it's a lot about his character and about how he manages to come up with answers to questions that, in hindsight, we sort of think, oh, goodness, okay, I see where he got that. But we never come up with it ahead of time. And just the characters have come down, you know, for over 100 years as being attractive and interesting. We love the intelligence and the wit of Sherlock. We love the grounded capability of Watson. You know, we absolutely love the kind of silly maternal qualities of Mrs. Hudson. These are characters that we recognize and that we like. And then we, of course, the stories are always a lot of fun as the pieces come together.
Edgar Allan Poe had C. Auguste Dupin, and Agatha Christie, of course, has Hercule Poirot, and Dorothy Sayers had Lord Peter Wimsey. Holmes and his deerstalker cat, his calabash pipe, his dressing gown, and his bohemian habits attracts us to the type of guy he is. And I kind of like the portrayal of that Jude Law and Robert Downey do in the newest incarnation of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, and it's a fun adaptation as well. I think, you know, most of the deerstalker stuff and a lot of the things that we think of in terms of Sherlock Holmes ended up coming later in the movies. You know, the Basil Rathbone ones,
sure,
or the Jeremy Brett BBC series. So much of it, kind of the lore of it and the building of the legend of what Sherlock Holmes is, has come as different directors and designers and artists have, you know, rethought him and reimagined him over the years. And so it's a real lot of fun to play with those things that you know an audience is going to automatically recognize and connect with, and then also bring a little bit of a flair somehow, you know, add another layer to this incredible character.
Well, we always thought that the Reichenbach Falls would be Sherlock's last case, but this is going to be Sherlock's last case. So without giving too much away, give us a little bit to what to expect, Janice.
Well, actually, Conan Doyle tried to kill off Holmes after Reichenbach Falls, and he went about 10 years, but everyone wanted more Sherlock Holmes, so he ended up bringing him back and writing some more stories. Sherlock's last case, the idea of this play, is that it is many years after Reichenbach Falls, both Holmes and Watson believe very firmly that Moriarty is dead and gone, and now they can just kind of, you know, live out of retirement, as it were. And without giving too much away, they start receiving letters from the children of Moriarty saying that we are here to revenge our father's death, and the mystery continues from there.
And the kids are as miserable as the father is.
Absolutely horrible, yes.
Well, that's not unusual, right, in this day and age?
Oh, right. No, you never see that. That's crazy.
Well, that's exciting. And then you can kind of let your imagination go from there. That's fun.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, it's surprising. The show is very funny, but it's not making fun of Holmes and Watson. It's not, you know, a lark on it. It's kind of taking their characters and expanding them further, and a lot of the humor comes from the characterizations themselves. I mean, you've got to admit, it's got to be hard to live with Holmes, someone who is so smart and so cutting and so witty and
right,
so far ahead of you, that I'm sure as a roommate he would be absolutely horrible.
Only John Watson could do it.
Exactly, and so that's where a lot of the humor comes from, and a lot of how these characters interact, and also a lot of it comes from, if you know a lot of Sherlock Holmes stuff, if you're really a big fan, you're going to really enjoy all of the little nods to previous cases and stories that you might have seen and heard. But if you don't know any Sherlock Holmes, if this were your first introduction, you'd still easily be able to follow this story and easily be connected with these characters.
And actually, Conan Doyle modeled this after one of his teachers in medical school, Joseph Bell.
I read that.
Yeah,
I think he must have been kind of a horrible professor.
My studies have told me that it's because of the type of person Joseph Bell was, in that there was a link between his medical investigation and what Conan Doyle saw as the kind of the, what would you say, detection of crime or interest in crime and so forth. And he kind of put that, the way they put that together.
A little bit of that forensics.
Yeah, a little bit. But I was always kind of fascinated by it. I always thought Mycroft was an interesting character, Janice.
I always thought Mycroft was brilliantly fun.
Yeah.
He is not, unfortunately, featured in this show. I apologize. But, yeah.
Well, he might be in the audience, though, right?
Yes, absolutely. Every night.
And, of course, this is not your first time being at First Folio Theater. You've done such great stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Or great work. Having done so much Shakespearean drama and so forth, I think that it must be an interesting change, transition over to do something like this, which is serious, but also, you, like you say, you bring a little humor into it.
Well, and that's very true. But I think the thing that holds over for me as someone who mostly directs classical theater, mostly directs Shakespeare and plays that are very much about language, is that fortunately Sherlock is a lot about language. He is a very chatty character, and how he says what he says is so important to us as an audience getting the sense of him, and when he's being cutting and when he's being charming and when he's being funny and all of those different things. So for me as a director, it was actually pretty easy to slip over into this play, as Marowitz has let these characters speak the way they often speak in the books. So again, it's kind of, it's a play of language. It's a lot more about the conversation and the word choices and the jokes, the language jokes, rather than, you know, a visual kind of experience. However, that said, I have to tell you, I'm so ridiculously proud of the design of this show. It's absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. The scenic design by Angie Weber-Miller and the lighting design by Diane Fairchild, it's layers and layers of light, and it, you know, makes the scenery look absolutely beautiful. And then we have a terrific costume designer, and Rachel has really brought great period looking stuff. So I think it's a very lush looking production. It's visually stunning, but at the same time, this play is mostly about the words, mostly about the language.
Do we get to see 221B Baker Street?
Absolutely. Most of the play takes place at 221B.
Once I eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, that is usually the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we'll find out at the first Folio Theaters production of Sherlock's Last Case, correct?
That's correct.
What's next up for Janice Blix? Don't I know a guy by the name of David Blix? Is he any relation?
I know a guy named David Blix. I am married to that guy.
You know, I wish I could get out there, but I enjoy getting all the information from your Michigan Shakespeare Festival, and I think I've heard that it was a great success this year, as it always is.
Terrific, absolutely. And that David Blix guy you mentioned played Cyrano de Bergerac this year.
He did.
Yeah, and it was a terrific, wonderful production. Next up for me is I'm going to be directing Henry V next year and a really silly comedy called Charlie's Aunt.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
And that's going to be at the First Folio?
No, that's going to be at Michigan.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Great. So Michigan also doesn't just do Shakespeare, it does some contemporary.
Well, what we always do is we do two plays by Shakespeare, one a very well-known and one a lesser-known, lesser-produced. And then our third production is what you might consider a classical play, i.e. it's not, you know, in the past 50 years or so, but it's by a different author.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done Wilde, we've done Chekhov, we've done Molière. So every year there's at least one show that's not Shakespeare. And next year I decided just to do something funny and silly. And, you know, we're coming up on elections, and I think everyone's going to need a little time out to just have a good time.
There you go. That's a great idea. But right now we can enjoy Sherlock's Last Case. The genius of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle always shows up in the first paragraph of his Sherlock Holmes adventures, often before the great fictional detective agrees to take on whatever case he's about to crack. That's when Holmes inevitably examines a small mundane object and reveals almost all there is to know about the item's owner. At first, it seems like magic. How else to explain Holmes' ability to glance at, for example, a walking stick, and then correctly deduce the age, profession, and ambitions of its owner, as well as the size of his dog? When Holmes explains how he does it, the magic falls away, his deductions suddenly seem so obvious that you'll feel stupid for not seeing them yourself. As the super sleuth points out, the world is full of obvious things that go unnoticed. As the premier nonprofit professional theater in the western suburbs, First Folio's mission is to present intimate productions of classic and contemporary works. By making our home residence in May Lake Peabody Estate, we create a unique theatrical experience that enriches the community. First Folio Theater is in its 23rd season of bringing high-quality performances of Shakespeare and other classics to the Chicagoland suburbs. During that time, the theater has grown from an annual summer show to a year-round operation with both indoor and outdoor stages. To open its 24th season, First Folio Theater will begin with the literary-inspired production Sherlock's Last Case by Charles Merowitz. A threat hangs over the world's most famous detective as he faces an opponent he never expected. The thrilling adventure mixes suspense, humor, and breath-stopping surprises, directed by Janice Blix. Sherlock's Last Case runs through November 3rd, and on the line with us right now is Janice Blix. Janice, I'm going to give a phone number if people would like to get some tickets, 630-986-8067. Would you please keep us tuned in on what Janice Blix is doing and also what David Blix is doing?
I absolutely will, Kevin. Thank you so much. And I should say that this show is selling out. A lot of performances are already sold out. So if this is a show that interests you, call that number fast.
First Folio Theater always has a habit of doing that, selling out all their shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's terrific. But, yes, we're all looking forward to seeing it. And, again, if people would like tickets, 630-986-8067. Janice, thanks for taking a little time and chatting with us.
Oh, thank you so much. This was delightful.
And our best to David.
Absolutely.
Thank you, dear.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you would like to see some Sherlock Holmes, please go to First Folio Theater. It's right in Oak Brook, very easy to get to off 31st Street and Route 83, First Folio Theater. And enjoy this. Do a little background research on Sherlock if you don't know a lot about him, because he's a very interesting character. But his last case through November 3rd at First Folio Theater, I think you'll enjoy it. And Janice does a terrific job with it. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, Ashley Weider, award-winning star of stage, screen, and television, and the artistic director of the world-famous Joffrey Ballet, now presenting the Chicago premiere of Kathy Marston's Jane Eyre, October 16th through the 27th at the Auditorium Theater of Roosevelt University, Michigan at Congress. For information, 312-386-8905. And Janice Blix, the award-winning director, now directing the Charles Mirowitz production of Sherlock's Last Case at First Folio Theater, located at the Mays Lake Peabody Estate, Route 83 and 31st Street in Oak Brook. The game's afoot. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought, every day at least, to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week, and as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Enjoy our beautiful autumn.
I know the way I feel for you. It's now or never. The more I love, the more that I'm afraid. But in your eyes, I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, any luck then I suppose. The music, the music. Yeah.